We have 11 signed up, along with Professor Patterson, who I know who has some class obligations, or at least grading obligations right now. And having been waiting for a professor to grade papers, I will don't want to hold you too long. And I don't want to put you in a good mood or bad mood for grading papers, but if you could speak first to us, I think you were going to speak to us about the legal, where we are in the framework, so as to help educate the members where things stand within the context of case law and statutory law at this point, constitutional law. So, Professor Patterson, if you'd come forward, and we'd love to hear from you.
Good morning. As you indicated, I was asked to come this morning to address legal issues related to S-111 and H-3213. I'm going to touch on a few key points and then, of course, would be happy to answer any questions that I'm able to. As I think the staff told you, I was had only less than 24 hours to prepare, and so I'm not necessarily as on top of everything as I would like to be, but have tried to get the key issues together. I'm going to divide my remarks up into two sections. First, I want to talk about the abortion context, and then I want to talk about the broader state law context into which this bill would fit. In regard to abortion, the effect of, and I'm going to talk about S-111 and 3213 and not the bill that is focused on the criminal liability. The effect would be that under state law, the fetus would be on the same legal footing as the pregnant woman. And in that legal milieu, there can be no right to abortion. The way that the Supreme Court was looking at abortion, you have a woman's autonomy right and the state's interest in protecting the fetus. Under this law, in the state, you would have the woman's autonomy right and the fetus's right to life as a separate and independent person. And in that context, there can be no right to abortion. So, and potentially not even when the life or health of the mother is jeopardized. So passage of this bill then, first of all, would create an immediate conflict with the state abortion statutes. And secondly, it would be clearly unconstitutional. Not going all the way back to Roe v. Wade, but in 1992 in the case of Casey versus Planned Parenthood, which was reaffirmed in 2000 by another opinion, the court reaffirmed the constitutional right of a woman to choose to have an abortion prior to viability, and even after viability, the state must allow abortions that are necessary to the life or health of the woman. The effect on abortion of S-111 and H-3213 within the state would be clearly in conflict with the current Supreme Court law in that area. The second area that I want to address is the broader context of state law. Essentially, in state law in South Carolina, as elsewhere in the United States, state law reflects centuries of Anglo-American law that have developed around the assumption that that legal personhood begins at birth. This bill, which gives a fetus or even a fertilized egg equal legal standing with persons, with independent, freestanding persons, would send ripple effects throughout the law. I've selected just five examples that I want to present to you to give you an idea of what I'm referring to. It may be that the changes, that these ripple effects represent changes that you desire to make in the law, but these ramifications need to be clearly considered, and there needs to be an awareness of the extent of the changes that would come about as the effect of this law. I want to emphasize before I talk about those specific issues that these issues would be important even if the bill only applied to viable fetuses, but their significance is magnified when you go all the way back to the fertilization of the egg, particularly when you consider the high incidence of miscarriage. I did some quick research on the web last night and came up with the following statistics, that 50% of fertilized eggs are miscarried before implantation in the womb. 30% of those that remain are miscarried in the first 30 days thereafter, and then 25% of the rest in the next 60 days. So that's a very large percentage of, if you go all the way back to the fertilized egg, that are not going to make it to the point of birth. So you will have a person who has equal legal standing with all other persons whose only life may be a few days, a few weeks in utero. And that is really has some major ramifications in different areas of law. So let me talk about, I'll give you these five examples, and remembering that I haven't had the time to really flesh these out, but they're just an example of some of the kinds of things that you need to think about. First of all, inheritance and property rights, including trusts. You're going to have a fertilized egg that may have may have the right to intestate succession from a person, may have a right to distributions under a trust, and this may be a fertilized egg that will never, in fact, be born. There are all kinds of scenarios that can arise from that. Secondly, child support. Can a pregnant woman collect child support for the fertilized egg, for the embryo, the fetus? Third, tort liability, particularly where the woman is injured in early pregnancy. There are various issues that may challenge tort law, looking at, for instance, if you have an injury to a pregnant woman or a possible injury, and then there's a miscarriage. Was that one of those 50% that was going to happen, or is it somehow related to this incident? If the mom is killed, and therefore the fertilized egg is killed, et cetera, is there, under what circumstances is there liability for the death of the fertilized egg or the embryo? How do you measure damages when there was at least a 50% chance or around a 50% chance that it would have not survived to birth? And then if you take tort liability over in the workman's compensation context, if the fetus is a separate person, that separate person is not an employee. So if there is an on-the-job injury to a pregnant woman that also has an impact on the fetus, then how does that fit within the context of workers' compensation law? The fourth area relates to the conduct of the mother during the pregnancy, including times when she may be unaware that she's pregnant. Can she be prevented from or held liable for such things as smoking, engaging in strenuous physical activity, taking medicines that pose a risk to the fetus? Notice that by giving the fertilized egg, embryo, fetus, whatever stage it's in, equal legal status, you're creating a very unique situation of two legal persons who are physiologically integrated, and that can create real problems in terms of maternal liability. And then the fifth area I wanted to mention, it has to do with life and health insurance, where particularly as related to family coverage under group policies. Will or can a fertilized egg, embryo, or fetus be covered under the policy so that if it subsequently miscarries, it is possible to collect on life insurance? And how does that relate to the health insurance as well? If a woman has a self-only insurance policy, will services relating to fetal well-being be covered since the fetus is a separate person? These are just complications in the law. They can be addressed, although they are, as I say, only examples of the many ramifications of giving full legal personhood to a fetus that has not yet been born. But it's the kind of thing that you really shouldn't rush into a bill without thinking about whether you intend to affect all of these areas of law and in what way you intend to affect them. Just in conclusion, I don't really know what the objectives were that led to the introduction of the bill in particular. If what the bill's objectives are is to try to prohibit abortion, then it is clearly unconstitutional. If what the bill is trying to do is extend current law about feticide and wrongful death beyond the viable fetus to other stages of development, then it would be better, in my view, to focus on a bill that does that. If the objectives are something else, then those objectives could be identified and dealt with, and any complications attached to them could be dealt with. But this bill is really very broad, and what I would like you to take from my comments is basically an understanding of the breadth of the effects of the bill and the need to think about some of these areas that will be affected.
Thank you, Professor. Anyone in the committee's questions? Senator from Richland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Professor Patterson. I really don't know where to begin. I think you've done an excellent job, and you know, I had asked that we have somebody from the School of Law to come talk to us about what I believe to be are some fairly broad ramifications, but I'm not a lawyer. Everyone else in my family is, but I'm not. I'm a retailer. That's right. But you raise a lot of questions, and I want to just kind of make sure I understand that, because I, you know, take what we may do today or in a subsequent meeting very seriously, you know, and I want to just kind of walk back through that with the Mr. Chairman, with your permission, and Professor Patterson. I don't intend to keep you here for an hour, but I want to make sure I understand something. Number one, when you talk about inheritance and property rights for a fetus, how under current law is that treated? In other words, we have a viability definition now that says, is it 24 weeks? Is that right? How many weeks is?
Frankly, I'm not sure. Usually somewhere in that 24 to 28 is where viability is placed.
Okay. All right. And for a 20-week fetus, mm-hmm. under current South Carolina law, how are issues like inheritance and property rights treated now?
I believe that that if the fetus is subsequently born alive, that it will share in the distribution of, say, to my children or whatever. But if it's not born alive, then it will not share.
Okay.
And I think that's true of a viable fetus as well. The Whitner case, which held that a viable fetus was a person, was making that holding in reference to a specific statutory term, which was the definition of child or person in the Children's Code for purposes of criminal child abuse or neglect.
But when you're saying born alive, so in other words, the fetus
yeah.
has to be born, though.
Yes.
Okay, so in other words, under current law, a 30-week fetus, would that have inheritance or property rights if it's not born?
No.
It would not. Okay.
No.
Okay.
There are all these stories about the father with his ear to the door to hear the cry of the child when it's born, because that makes all the difference in various property rights.
Okay. Okay. But it has to be born under current law.
Yes.
Okay. All right. You talked about high percentage of miscarriages.
Mm-hmm.
And I started writing down these statistics, and then I kind of got lost when we were talking about 25% of 30% of 50%.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Can you walk back through those with me real quickly, if you can?
It's very high for a fertilized egg prior to implantation in the womb, 50%. And that's, you know, just right there in that very first couple of days or first day. I'm not sure exactly what time frame. Then if it gets implanted in the womb, when you go beyond that, then it's 30% in the first 30 days thereafter, then 25% in the next 60 days, and then it drops dramatically after that first trimester.
Okay. Okay. But technically, under the language, though, this creates personhood at the point of fertilization,
yes.
I think, if I read that correctly, right?
And regardless of whether the child is subsequently born alive.
Right. What are your thoughts about how birth control, the pill, you know, plays into all this? You know, because we heard testimony last week from I forgot. I think it was somebody from the pharmaceutical industry.
Mm-hmm.
Makes drugs, right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That many forms of birth control pills basically work after fertilization.
Mm-hmm.
So, hypothetically, this law would basically say that that fertilized egg has rights before the birth control pill did its thing.
Yeah. That is correct. I think that would fall within the part of the bill that is clearly unconstitutional, because there you're getting into that woman's right to of choice about whether or not to have a child. So, you know, A, yes, that's correct that it would apply. B, it's within the applications of the bill that would be unconstitutional. Not every application is necessarily unconstitutional.
And I think, and I'm certainly, not only am I a lawyer, I'm not a doctor either, but I think the pills we're talking about, we're not talking about morning after pills.
Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about a woman's right to choose. We're not even talking about choosing to have an abortion. We're talking about a woman that takes a pill
mm-hmm.
24 days a month, or however many days, you know, or, you know, that takes the birth control pill on a regular basis, years and years and years, to, you know, as part of her, you know, family planning.
Mm-hmm.
And so under this proposal, technically that the way these pills work, that egg can be fertilized, and then that fertilization can be, for lack of a better term, ended
mm-hmm.
With the use of a birth control pill. So they hypothetically would become somewhat illegal.
Until the constitutional challenge went through, yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator from Dorchester.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Law involved, it becomes more complicated,
mm-hmm.
and I guess that's what lawyers do.
Well, you point out the ways in which it's complicated.
Yeah.
You don't make it.
But what kind of a, you know, and the only time that you mention the father is when he's listening to the door for the baby to cry. But some, you know, you just don't walk along the street and become pregnant. Why isn't that father involved in this for the first 9 months, number one? And what can we do to simplify this thing to stop the abortion bills? I think that's what people's all upset about. They're not really, you know, if your wife's laying there and she's going to die, or the baby, I'd say most men are going to say, let my wife live.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think nobody in here, even though they may say so, until they walk a mile in their mm-hmm. shoes, that would want their daughter to have a baby for their son. And most people won't want a child to have a baby by rape.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, what I would like to see, instead of trying to make everything complicated, let's come back with something that says we're going to use common sense, and that these abortion mills have to stop, that you just cannot use abortion for birth control. You go out on a party one weekend, you find out you're pregnant, no problem, I just might not get an abortion.
Mm-hmm.
That's not right. That's wrong. I don't think you'll ever stop abortion. There's always going to be somebody in the back alley that's willing mm-hmm. to perform an abortion. But it cannot be the law of this land to use abortion as birth control. And I think that's what we need to work toward. And that's what would satisfy me.
I understand that many people share your views on that. And there are states that would like to bring about that result. However, that's one of the things that has been addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court, and therefore the states do not have the flexibility to make those choices at this point in time.
So we have a real liberal Supreme Court.
Well, whether or not it's real liberal, and at this point in time, you know, we've always heard it's just one vote difference, et cetera. Right now, it's not one vote difference. It's 6-3. And so the right to abortion is firmly ensconced in the constitutional law of the United States at this time.
Thank you.
A follow-up question.
Can't resist, can you?
I just want to ask one.
Go ahead. Senator from Richland.
Professor Patterson. Just a follow-up question to Senator Scott's question. can states pass laws that supersede federal law?
No, they cannot. There's the preemption, federal preemption. If state law is preempted, then you cannot pass a law. And with the U.S. Supreme Court rulings would be to the effect that a state law doing certain things is unconstitutional, and that's what we're dealing with in this area.
Thank you.
Thank you, Professor. I just want to do one cleanup matter here. The preemption question.
Mm-hmm.
I take it you're taking the position, obviously, that the preemption question as it relates to abortion has been by the federal government is in place. But at this time.
It's not exactly preemption, because preemption, you know, is federal statutes, whereas here we're talking about a constitutional ruling.
I don't mean preemption as a term of art, but I mean
as
essentially determining what the law of the land is.
Yes.
As opposed to a state's determination.
Right.
But there is, within that framework, they have not preempted nor occupied the field as it relates to state's determination for criminal liability of an unborn child.
That's right.
And so that part would be permissible in South Carolina as it has been in other states.
Yes, and all of those areas at the end where I was talking about the property and the insurance and whatever, the state can make those determinations. It is the right to make a choice about whether or not to have a child that the constitutional ruling applies to. Now, it's possible that in some other area you would run into a different constitutional principle, but that principle would not apply.
I just want to make sure that the subcommittee understood there's a difference.
Exactly. Okay. And the one thing I would like to mention is that in regard to the other bill that is before the committee, the subcommittee,
479,
that deals with criminal liability, does that bill only deal with criminal liability or also with tort liability, wrongful death?
It's got wrongful death survival issues in it.
Okay.
And we're not actually going to get into that bill today.
Okay.
I think you may have heard me say before, we've now surveyed the other states to see how they deal with it. And I think we're going to digest those other statutes and see how we do within that before we actually tackle that one.
The primary thing that I would mention in regard to tort liability is to the importance of thinking about whether or not it's necessary for the fetus to survive in order to have tort liability. Of course, within wrongful death is another matter, but that's a really key issue that I just want to mention as one that you should think about that is not actually addressed in the bill.
And obviously tied back to the survival would be the proximate cause question. Is that where you're coming from?
That's one of the key issues, yeah.
Well, I think we'll have to flesh those issues out probably in another forum, but maybe we'll have you back or other legal folks back and give you a break on that one.
Okay.
But thank you so much, and we appreciate you coming down at a busy time of your spring.
One more question, Mr. Chairman.
Senator from Dorchester.
Professor Patterson, I've heard it said that a minor, a child, 14, 15-year-old child, can go down and have an abortion without permission of the parents. Is that true?
It may be necessary to there's a way that the child can go through a court procedure that substitutes for parental consent, and the court will either decide that the minor is mature enough to make the decision on her own or that it's in the minor's best interest to have an abortion. And the vast majority of those cases, the court does decide to allow the abortion.
And if that same minor would come by my house and throw a brick and break my windshield, and the parents are liable?
Not necessarily.
Something's wrong with that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Next we have Johnny Gardner. And if you would say whom you represent when you speak, and again, I obviously we've heard the legal framework, so I don't ask you to speak to that, but you're welcome to comment on any portion you'd like. If you would get it to Allison, and she'll make it available. If anyone has any written materials they'd like to present to the committee in lieu of testimony or in addition to your testimony, we welcome that, and you can make it available to staff who will make it available to us.
I am
Gardner.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Senator and Senators. I'm Johnny Gardner, Director, a Voice of the Unborn, a minister the Lord led me to start, I guess, a little over 14 years ago. And before I get into my written speech, I written down something while the professor was speaking that I would like to remind you of, that speaking on Constitution, you know, our Attorney General said the bill is Constitution, and Constitution has one thing in common with my Bible. This Bible here, the King James Bible, was translated in 1611. And since we got it completed, it's not God's word is not changed. And the Constitution, except for amendments, has not changed. I don't care what the courts say, it still reads the same thing. But get into my written speech. We're here today. We ask you to favorably pass H-3213. It's a bill similar to the, I guess, S-11. And I will say this, it's either a life or it's not a life. As far as the thing about the amendment, as far as the Rivers rape exception, this bill is to determine if it's a life or not it's a life. And it is a life at fertilization or conception. But we do ask you to pass the Right to Life Act out of your subcommittee and send the bill to the full committee. We ought to obey what the Bible, God's Word, says, and not what someone interprets it to say. I used to know a pastor that used to tell his congregation, he said, "Don't tell me what the Bible teaches." He said, "You tell me what it says and let me decide what it's teaching." And I concur with that. I like to hear what the Bible says, and I believe the Bible. But we also ought to obey the Constitution as to what it says and not someone's interpretation. You've taken an oath to uphold the Constitution, not someone's interpretation. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution states that no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. And I don't think these have had due process of law. Abortion is murder of an unborn child. The Declaration of Independence states that life is a God-given right. Psalm 127:3, you'll find God's word agrees. Lo, children are an heritage of the Lord, and the fruit of the womb is his reward. And in Exodus 20:13, and also in Deuteronomy 5:17, the Bible says, "Thou shalt not kill." And that means we're not to commit murder. We're not to commit murder. Life begins at fertilization or conception. Jeremiah 1:5, "Before I formed thee in the belly, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee, and I ordained thee a prophet unto the nations." We must obey God for the safety of our state and nation. Psalm 9:17, "The wicked shall be turned into hell, and all the nations that forget God." Proverbs 14:34, "Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." It's very easy to see that we have forgotten God in our nation. Obey God so that our economy will be secure and stable. Matthew 6:33, "But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you." We need a lesson in God's mathematics. I've had people come to me and suggest that by murdering babies, they were helping feed people. Because they say, "Oh, preacher, we got more food left to feed people." But really, that's not true. In God's mathematics, we need a lesson there. When we disobey God, God will curse the ground. That's one thing he can do, so that the corn doesn't grow. God may give us rain out of season so that doesn't help our crops. So making God angry, don't give us more food to feed our people with. I mean, that's a lie from the devil. We need to turn back to God in obedience, lest he destroy our land. I believe the U.S. Constitution gives us the right to life from fertilization to the grave. According to the Constitution, Miss Terry Schiavo had the right to life, even though it was ignored by a bunch of liberal judges. I mean, that was really a shame. I mean, that thing broke my heart. I shed so many tears over that, because it reminded me of how far down my country's gone. And I just had to drop down where I was at as I went out to preach it. I just had to weep over it. But anyway, even if the law of our land allowed one to commit murder, the Constitution's the law of the land, which it doesn't. The Word of God is above the law of the land. God's law does not permit murder. We ought to always to obey the higher law. God's law is higher than the Supreme Court. Anytime man's law conflicts with God's law, we should obey God rather than man. So some say that what the Right to Life Act is passed, that that there's one way it become law. Actually, there's at least two ways, and one of them's going to sound a little radical to you, but there's two ways. And you don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure this out. One of them is Roe versus Wade being overturned. That'd be the law of South Carolina. But there is another way, and I've told people that, and the first time I told them, I knew they were going to figure I was joking. I said, but if South Carolina ever got brazen enough to get so sick of what's being done to us by this federal tyrannical rule that we have, decided we can't take it, and we decided to pull out of this union, it would also be the law of the land. Because I'm going to tell you something, folks. Whether you're dealing with an individual person or whether you're dealing with a state, we should always obey God. You know, right now the federal government has violated our Constitution in every way thinkable. When this country was formed, 13 colonies, we were like 13 countries joined together. And reading about my forefathers, one thing they feared, and we have it today, they feared a strong federal government. They wanted a strong state government. They wanted a weak federal government. Today we have the federal government usurping rights over the states that is not their rights to do. They violate the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. Well, anything that's not penned in that Constitution, the state has the right to do it. All right. Secondly, aside from that, they also, the 5th and the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, getting back to what the Constitution says, not what someone said that it says. It says no one's life may be deprived without due process of law. You know, up until a couple of months ago, I was kind of ignorant of a lot of the Constitution. My fault. It was like this Bible. If I don't read it, I'm ignorant, but it's my fault. Well, I mean, it was there for me to read, but I didn't. But, you know, reason I got to reading the Bible, I mean, the Constitution, and I got to noticing that the federal government has violated the Constitution. And I'm going to tell you what I believe. I don't think we have the support to do it, because I don't believe there's enough righteous people in South Carolina at this present time to bring it to pass. But that don't change truth none. I believe that when the federal government commands South Carolina to disobey God, if our people were righteous and holy and loved God and loved His Word, we'd reply back like those in the book of Acts that when they were told not to preach the Word of God, we would say, you decide whether we obey God or we obey man, but we refuse such a wicked order. I mean, even if we had to rebel, I mean, it would be the last. I would love to see all of the United States get saved. Matter of fact, I've prayed for America for so many years, but I finally got to praying this, and you might think it's ludicrous, but I says, God, if you see, and I've wept over this country, but I love my state of South Carolina more than I even love America. This is my state, and I love South Carolina. I says, God, if you see the United States but not get saved, God, would you save South Carolina? Would you sever off and save, get some states where you'd raise up a righteous generation? And that's what it would take. I'm a realist. I don't believe there's enough people in our state that would, most of them would think I'm a nut, probably even some of the churches. But I don't mind being thought a nut, because I believe the truth ought to be proclaimed. Matter of fact, I struggled before coming here. I prayed about it, and I believe the Lord told me to say it and to preach it. And the Lord told me this, don't worry about whether it happens or not, but you preach righteous concepts. I do believe this, that in my ministry, I'm sort of a forerunner, and God's only got me working on the fact there's things that I believe are going to happen probably after my death. In other words, it may be that after my death that I'll be sowed some seed that we'll get to a point one day we'll get sick of the federal tyranny, and maybe God could raise up enough righteous people in our state that would reject this idea that we can allow murder, because murder is never right, and God frowns on murder. And I thank you for hearing me. I don't know. Was there any questions?
Mr. Gardner, I appreciate you speaking before us this morning. Did anybody have any questions?
Thank you. Man.
Thank you so much. Next speaker we have is Steve LaFlemme from Columbia Christians for Life.
That's right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members, for conducting a second public hearing on this bill to allow others to speak. If you'd like to open up the packet, I tend to refer to some of the materials as I go through. Number one of my outline is concerning the text of the bill. Before I state that, I would like to state the purpose of the Right to Life Act, as has already been addressed, is to vest legal personhood at fertilization to pre-birth human beings under the South Carolina state constitution without any so-called exceptions, which would be a fatal flaw to the entire bill in logic and in law. And that is, in fact, as I'll hope to get to later, is what happened 32 years ago in a Texas law that was challenged. It became Roe v. Wade. My request is, as I begin the statement, is for the removal of the rape exception for so-called morning after pill, abortifacient, or chemical abortion-causing amendment that was added at the second reading in the House, and for passage of the bill as was originally introduced in its unamended form. As amended by the South Carolina House, the bill makes no sense in logic or law. And I'm glad the point was established during Senator Lori's questioning of the professor that, yes, in fact, there are chemical means where abortions can take place post-fertilization. We have to decide what the truth is. A good investigator, a good officer in law enforcement, I think, will investigate the truth, determine the facts, and let the facts bring him where they may. The facts are that life, a human entity, begins at fertilization. Number one on the outline is the text of the bill. It's a one-sentence bill. The right to due process, whereby no person may be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, and the right to equal protection of the laws, both of which rights are guaranteed by Article 1, Section 3 of the Constitution of this state, vest at fertilization. I think one of the House members in the House Judiciary Committee said something to the effect that this was not a bill about abortion, it's a bill about the right to life, the sanctity of life. And obviously, if we respect the sanctity of life, that would mean that innocent human life post-fertilization would not be permitted, and that would end the killing of children by the means of abortion in the womb. The next page is a page from the Constitution of the state. The authority for this bill comes from Article 1, Section 3, the latter part of which says, "Nor shall any person be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall any person be deprived of equal protection of the laws." So our state constitution already protects persons from being deprived of their life without due process of law. This bill simply, as we understand, vests legal personhood. And one of the points I'll make as I go along is, if we make an exception to personhood, that guts the whole bill. And this was documented by a footnote in the Roe v. Wade decision, footnote number 54, by Justice Harry Blackmun, who was ostensibly the author of Roe v. Wade. Item number three, I think we've touched on this already. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but the definitions of fertilization and implantation. Fertilization or conception is when the sperm, the haploid sperm and the haploid ovum come together and a complete set of 46 chromosomes is arrived at. About 5 to 7 days later, fertilized ovum has traveled down the fallopian tube, has already begun cell division, and it implants in the lining of the uterus at about 128 or 256 cells. So already about 7 or 8 cell divisions have occurred, and that's significant because that is already a living, growing organism, 5 to 7 days before it even gets down to implantation in the womb. Next, I'd like to touch on the issue of law, and I'm a little bit disappointed that during the law professor's presentation, I understand she said she only had about 24 hours or so, but nothing was made of the fact that on March 30th of this year, the South Carolina Attorney General issued an opinion on H. 3213. Now, this was first requested back in 2003, but it wasn't issued until March 30th, 2005, and I would like to get to that opinion in a moment. Number one, I'd like to lay a foundational, a fundamental foundational fact. In Article 6, the Constitution itself lays out what is the supreme law of the land. And it says, the Constitution and the laws of the United States, which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States, shall be the supreme law of the land. So the Constitution itself says that the Constitution, the laws of the United States, made in pursuance thereof, i.e. federal laws, and treaties are the supreme law of the land. Noticeably absent are Supreme Court decisions. They are not the supreme law of the land. They are binding on the parties to the case. They are binding as to the particulars of the case, but they are not the supreme law of the land. Therefore, Roe v. Wade is not the supreme law of the land. The U.S. Constitution is. U.S. Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia said several years ago, quote, there is nothing in the Constitution that guarantees the right to an abortion. He dismissed the idea that abortion is a constitutionally protected right. Certainly he would be one of those three that the law professor mentioned who would be opposed to the continuation of legitimizing Roe v. Wade. The next article is an article by co-authored by Herb Titus. He was co-founder of the Regent University Law School in Virginia Beach. He's also part of the law team for Chief Justice Roy Moore and Michael New. And for the sake of time, I'm not going to read the highlighted portion that you have in your article, but he addresses the Article 6 issue as well. He says, quote, what is clearly missing from this constitutional list of supreme laws is a court opinion. This was not an oversight. Our Constitution's writers knew that a court opinion could never be law, much less the supreme law of the land. This is especially true if that court opinion contradicted the Constitution itself. And at the end of that highlighted portion, he refers to Chief Justice John Marshall's opinion, Marbury versus Madison is of course what we're referring to here. He says that the Chief Justice established judicial review, the right of the court to review a statute to see if it conformed to the Constitution. He said that the written Constitution was just as binding on the courts as it were on Congress. Marshall, Chief Justice at the time, then did not establish the supremacy of the judges over the Constitution, but the supremacy of the Constitution over Congress, the President, and the laws and the courts. The three branches are co-equal, and each man, as Andrew Jackson asserted with the National Bank issue, each man who takes an oath to uphold the U.S. Constitution, and in your all cases also the South Carolina State Constitution, you take that oath, so help you God. And as your conscience dictates, you have an oath and a duty to the people of this state to uphold that Constitution as it is written, and as your conscience interprets it. I would like to get on now to Roe v. Wade, and there's in my view, and I think other people are seeing this too, it's you can find it on the internet, the key to unlocking the chains that have bound the effort to ban the killing of children in the womb by abortion for three decades now, the key to unlock that chain, one of them, is right here in the text of the Roe v. Wade decision. And if you look at, I have two pages from the decision. They're highlighted, the sections I'd like to refer to. The first one has to do with the issue of personhood. And the decision was ostensibly written by Supreme Court Justice Harry Blackmun. So these are his words. The appellee and certain amici argue that the fetus is a person. The appellee was the state of Texas, whose law was challenged. Argue that the fetus is a person within the language and meaning of the 14th Amendment. In support of this, they outline at length and in detail the well-known facts of fetal development. The court's not interested in the biological aspect. They don't care if the babies are people. They don't care if the babies are alive at fertilization. All this discussion we have about the biological facts, they were presented over three decades ago. And we can argue that, and we know that, and that ought to touch our hearts. It ought to move on our hearts when we realize that we've killed over 45 million children in this country. And their blood cries out to God for judgment, and it's coming upon this country. It's already been coming upon the country, and it will increase until either this nation is destroyed or we repent. But the court doesn't care. From a legal aspect, the issue is personhood. And here's what Blackmun said. If this suggestion of personhood is established, the appellant's case, the Norm McCorvey case, the pro-abortion case, of course collapses. for the fetus's right to life is then guaranteed specifically by the amendment. Blackmun himself said 32 years ago, if personhood is established for the fetus, the pro-abortion argument, the argument for abortion, for legalized abortion, collapses. That's what this bill does. This bill meets this text. It satisfies this text in Roe v. Wade by establishing personhood. That's what was missing. Texas tried to make the personhood argument 32 plus years ago, but they didn't. They had an exception, and I'll get to that in a minute. They failed in making the personhood argument. But Blackmun said if personhood was established, then the abortion argument would collapse. Conversely, and here's the second point. Let me back up a moment and comment on the Right to Life Act. If the Right to Life Act of South Carolina is passed, without any exceptions, it would accomplish what was missing in the Texas law that was challenged and became the Roe decision. The South Carolina Right to Life Act, as it was introduced in the House before it was amended and as it is still in this condition in S-111, the Right to Life Act would define in law that all, no exceptions, pre-birth human beings are legal persons at fertilization. However, if there are any so-called exceptions to legal personhood for any pre-birth human beings, then the South Carolina Right to Life Act would fall dead on its face. It would be internally self-contradictory and therefore logically nonsensical and legally indefensible, just as the Texas law challenged in Roe was over 30 years ago. And this is a lesson we still haven't apparently learned fully in 32 years, but I think more and more people are seeing why this is so. Let me go on to the footnote that addresses why any exceptions to legal personhood unravel the whole personhood argument. Again, this is not my opinion. This is the written, documented text of the Roe v. Wade decision, and this footnote is personally attributed to Justice Blackmun. And you have it on the second page of the Roe decision that I provide for you in the packet.
Steve, I don't mean to cut your time short at all, but we have less than an hour now to complete the hearing. I got about seven more folks want to be heard. I know you've got an extensive outline. If you could hit the highlights for us in the remaining few minutes.
All right.
So
I'll cut off everything after. I'll stop at item five, Mr. Chairman, if that will work.
That's fine. I just want you to, it's in your control, whatever you want us to hear in your highlights, but I want to make sure we accommodate other folks who want
to
hear.
All right. I will stop at item five. This is the most important part of what I'd like to say is we are meeting the Roe formula. In the footnote by Justice Blackmun, he said, when Texas urges, again, this is 32 years ago, when Texas urges that a fetus is entitled to 14th Amendment protection as a person, it faces a dilemma. Neither in Texas nor in any other state are all abortions prohibited. Despite broad prescription, an exception always exists. The exception in the Texas law for an abortion procured or attempted by medical advice for the purpose of saving the life of the mother is typical. But if the fetus is a person who is not to be deprived of life without due process of law, and if the mother's condition is the sole determinant, does not the Texas exception appear to be out of line with the amendment's command? Footnote by Justice Blackmun. Obviously, I disagree with Justice Blackmun on the issue of abortion. He was pro-abortion. I believe it's a grave wrong, violating the Sixth Commandment of God. But I agree with his logic. It's just common sense. If you say a child exists at fertilization, a human being exists at fertilization, then we make an exception. But in this case, they're not a person. That doesn't even make logical sense. And Blackmun's point was valid, and it has helped open the door to the flood of bloodshed that's come upon this nation for 32 years. So I implore you, gentlemen, to consider that exception. That the House tacked on by a little quickie voice vote. Some of the members weren't even aware. It was very interesting. Most of the votes, all the other votes, were by roll call vote. But that voice vote happened very quickly, and I don't even think some of the members were alert to it. I've tried to order the tape of the proceedings. Let me go on to the Attorney General's opinion, and I hope, gentlemen, you did receive the copy that I sent to you weeks ago. I know Senator Lurie has received his copy. Again, I'm disappointed that the professor from USC did not even mention the opinion the published opinion on March 30th of this year of the South Carolina Attorney General. For the sake of time, I'm just going to go right to the conclusion. The Attorney General, Henry McMaster, said, it is our opinion that H. 3213, the Right to Life Act, is constitutional on its face. Now, this was before it was amended. This opinion was given in its unamended status, and he said it was constitutional on its face. Then he did address that if it was applied to abortion, there would be adjudication required. In my view, this personhood bill satisfies the condition that Justice Blackmun laid out, that if personhood was established, then the pro-abortion argument collapses. So it really satisfies the text of Roe v. Wade. And I'll finish up with the legislation in other states. Mr. Chairman, I'm glad to hear you mention that other states are pursuing, do have pending legislation similar to the Right to Life Act. In fact, the states of Georgia, North Dakota, and Ohio, and in addition to South Carolina, have active bills this year which are principled, no exceptions legislation. The North Dakota bill was defeated in the House, in the North Dakota House earlier this year. Ohio just filed theirs, and Georgia, I don't know the status of Ohio. Interesting enough, even in New Hampshire, back in the 2003 session, New Hampshire filed a bill that was a principled bill. So I will conclude there, gentlemen. I urge you in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, Yeshua Messiah, that as you vote on this bill, you will vote to please save this bill, which was conceived in 1997 and first filed in February 1998 in both the South Carolina House and the South Carolina Senate, and remove the rape exception, morning after pill, abortifacient, that is chemical abortion causing amendment, and restore the bill to its original unamended condition and pass the bill favorably out of this subcommittee.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you.
Senator from Richland.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tell me how to pronounce your last name. I'm sorry.
Lefferman. Steve Lefferman. Yes.
Mr. Lefferman, I have a quick question for you. And thank you for providing us this information. It's a lot of information, and you've done a lot of work on this, and I think myself and the other members of this committee are grateful for your work and your interest in providing all this information. In your opinion, this bill is about ending abortion. Is that correct, or is this bill about ending abortion?
I shared the words of the House member in the Judiciary Committee that he said, this bill was not about abortion, but it was about the sanctity of life. And I added on to that my own words that if we respect the sanctity of life, it will end abortion.
Okay.
The purpose of this bill is to bring an end to the murder of children in the womb by abortion or by any means, but especially by abortion, surgical or chemical, beginning at fertilization.
Okay. How would you react to the statements made by the senator from Greenville, Senator Fair, who's the primary sponsor of S-111, who came in here and in his testimony said this bill is not about abortion. This bill is about unborn fetuses and protecting their rights, as you know, giving them rights as personhood and so forth. Do you agree with that statement, or does that conflict with what you just said? Because I'm reading this thing right here, the third line says South Carolina's pro-life bill to end legalized abortion.
Yes, sir.
So I'm conflicted and struggling with your testimony versus his testimony.
They're two sides of the same coin. Just like the House member on the Judiciary Committee said, it not being about abortion but about the sanctity of life. One way to look at it is framing the argument. We're not just anti-abortion. We're pro-life. And our state constitution and the U.S. Constitution have already established that no person shall be deprived of life without due process of law. We already have a pro-life constitution and a pro-life state constitution, federal and state constitution. This Right to Life Act simply puts, it vests legal personhood beginning unequivocally at fertilization.
So yeah.
It's two sides of the same coin, Senator.
Right. I think everyone is probably anti-abortion. I think everyone considers themselves, at least most people, anti-abortion. Nobody looks forward to the thought of an individual having an abortion. I guess the real question is whether states can do things that the Supreme Court has said one thing. And last quick question: you mentioned chemical abortions. And I'm not referring to the morning after pill. I'm referring to birth control, you know, the birth control pill that women take, you know, which, according to the testimony we heard last week from a representative from the pharmaceutical industry, said because some pills basically work after fertilization takes place, is your intent to prohibit use of that pill, therefore preventing those pregnancies or those fertilizations from coming to an end, you know, by way of women using birth control pills?
I mentioned earlier, Senator, that a good person in law enforcement or an investigation will determine the facts and see where the facts take us. If it's determined, and I believe that's the case, that the birth control pills do in some cases cause chemical abortion, then we should have the integrity, the moral, ethical integrity to take us where that path leads. God's already established in his word in Exodus 20:13, thou shalt not kill, in the sense of murder. Not a man in this room, not a woman in this room has the authority to change what is written eternally in heaven. If we determine that a chemical procedure or a mechanical procedure or a surgical procedure ends a human life after it's already been begun, at fertilization, not implantation, we should have the courage and the faithfulness to the sovereign God of the universe to take us where those facts lead us.
Mr. LeFemin, you've been very open and honest with me, and I appreciate that.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Let me sort of put some structure around this. We have heard through, I think, an hour or so's testimony last week and a little over an hour today, a number of arguments both for and against the bill and some legal review of the bill. For those of you who are remaining to be speakers, I would sincerely ask that you bring to us testimony that is in addition to what we've already heard, because we've really covered the waterfront and the basic for and against of this legislation based on faith and law and whichever way that takes you, as well as experience and as well as medicine. So if you can add to the discussion, we welcome you, but we'd ask that you not repeat what we've already learned. And in that vein, the next person that's signed up is Kim Hendricks.
I'm going to try and give you the Reader's Digest version. I'm neither a doctor nor a lawyer. However, I do have personal testimony.
If you're representing an organization, if you'd let us know that, I'd appreciate it.
Really, I'm not. I'm in favor of a lot of these organizations. However, I'm...
Just you.
Yeah.
Welcome.
See, I made the mistake of having abortion at age 18. I now suffer from PASS, which is post-abortion stress syndrome. As you may know, it's acknowledged by the U.S. Senate as of November 6, 2001, H.R. 3061, as being an illness of abortion victims. I would spend the next 20 years in and out of mental institutions, not knowing why I couldn't form lasting relationship with peers, family members, namely children, and even why I seemed to be in mourning, as in the death of a loved one. Not to mention the extreme guilt I experienced. After admitting to the abortion, counselors would then tell me about PASS, and I have documentation on medical section 1. Doctors would also tell me that I would never conceive children again because of the harmful effects that abortion had on my body. The clinic where the operation was performed didn't warn me of the harmful effects, but seemed quite eager to collect a fee for the procedure. I've also included a recent finding that a woman who chooses to abort increases the risk of breast cancer in comparison to those who carry full term. Women who abort are more likely to report frequent and recent use of alcohol and drug abuse. They're also likely to have higher levels of anxiety, depression, and unresolved guilt. My boyfriend at the time begged and pleaded for me to cancel the abortion, but to no avail. Please, I may never be able to have another child. My selfish agenda was more important. He said he loved me and he would make me proud as the father of our child. Nevertheless, I took our child's life. I didn't realize that men too suffer from these harmful effects, post-traumatic stress syndrome, as well as post-abortion stress syndrome. And I have studies on this on Section 4. Pro-choicers may argue that an unborn child is not alive until it's completely 100% exited the womb. But if that argument is to be effective, we must conclude that if a thief comes into a bank and grabs money, he is not a thief unless the guard stops him before he completely exits the bank. That if a man shoots another, then tosses them into the river and they drown, the first is not attempted murder because it's not completely the cause of death. Finally, that a football player should not be awarded a touchdown unless he is completely within the end zone. And in other words, this logic doesn't stand up in any area of our society. I was finally granted another child. I could feel her move in my womb constantly, more so when she would hear the slightest noise, soothing music, or she would feel the touch of her father's hand on my womb. I'm Kim, and I'm for the woman, the unborn child, and the man.
Thank you so much, Ms. Hendrick. Anybody have any questions? Thank you for coming for us this morning. Our next speaker is Mr. Gerald Nags. I'm sorry, it's N-A-G-Y. Okay, fix that.
I'd like to keep it short, gentlemen. I'd like to ask, is a transcript available of today's hearings? I would love to do some research to rebut what the law professor presented this morning.
We can certainly see if there would be a transcript. If not, then I'm sure that the professor might be able to. It's being recorded, so if you could work with staff, and I would think that.
Oh, that's okay. I
would think the process would be submitting a cassette. We'll make a dub copy and a CD. We're very, very high-tech in the Senate these days. CD.
Okay. Well, I'll try to keep it.
We must have teenagers in charge. They're the only ones I know that can make CDs. So. I'm sorry, Mr. Nagy. It looks like you're representing an organization. Would you
tell
us what that is?
Well, actually, I'm director of a new ministry just being started. It's a ministry that helps to missionaries dealing with web presence and such as that. But in lieu of just speaking individually.
Could you tell us the name of that organization?
Yes, Into All the World Ministries.
Into All the World Ministries. Okay, great. Okay. And again, if you just add to the conversation what we've not yet heard.
Yes, sir, and I guess I have a little bit of a different take on the situation, and it's something I just literally 3.5 minutes, if you'll indulge me.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and honorable members of this subcommittee, thank you for the privilege of addressing you. I'm asking you to favorably pass H-3213 without amendments onto the full committee. A few weeks back, while considering what to say to you gentlemen the evening before the first of these meetings, it occurred to me that even a first-term senator within a few months of taking office may go through more of these presentations listening than most of us ever could in a lifetime of giving them. So I asked myself, what can one man say in a matter of minutes that would convince you to champion the cause of unborn children if you were not so inclined before you arrived here today? I knew that you would hear much holy scripture. As good as God has said, his word would not return void. In Exodus 20:13, God has said, "Thou shalt not kill." Translated, it's the shortest of all 10 commandments, very succinct, with absolutely no wiggle room. However, I'm certain you've heard this your entire life, and my repeating it once more, well, it probably won't cause you to change your mind in the next few minutes. Then I thought of the last time I spoke before legislators. I compared the law of gravity to the laws of God. It was well prepared, almost a sermonette with points well taken. I had considered repeating that short talk. The only problem is it, too, would not serve to change your mind in the next few minutes. I even thought to tell you how for years I followed the wisdom in that old adage about laws and sausage, but how my passion to help stop the murder of unborn children now motivates me to speak here before you today. But to what end? In this world, there are many passionate people, some with some very bad ideas, so even my passion would not cause you to change your mind in the next few minutes. In reality, gentlemen, I believe there's nothing I can say that would cause you to alter your positions on these bills, at least not, again, within the next few minutes. So why am I here? I'm here to tell you that there was and is something I could and couldn't do, and that means I can pray for you. In Romans 13:1, God tells us, "Let every soul be subject unto higher powers, for there is no power but of God. The powers that be are ordained of God." Well, we often hear how the Lord God hardened an Egyptian Pharaoh's heart to save his people. We are seldom reminded how that same God softened a Persian king's heart to towards a maiden named Esther to save that same nation of Israel, once again in captivity many years later. In each case, the attitude of the leader's heart had a direct bearing on God's treatment of the nation that they governed. None of you here today have the power of a pharaoh or a king, but you are the higher powers, and therefore your position and authority are ordained of God, regardless of your personal relationship with him. To that end, I knew when I was first done writing this talk, beginning that very night, prayer would ensue. Not every day, but often since then, myself and others have been praying for everybody here in this room. Last Wednesday evening, in my church, we asked for prayer for each of you by name. I knew that especially this morning before this hearings began, many of us gathered in this room would lift you up in prayer, and that regardless of the outcome here today, I know many people will continue to pray for you. That prayer was and is a simple one, that you would listen to the voice of God, harden your heart towards those that would continue these murders, and soften your heart towards the lives of the innocent unborn babies that remain to be saved. Gentlemen, there are not thousands, not millions, but tens of millions of souls whose blood cries out from the ground. The voice you hear in your ears at this moment is just that of one man speaking. Me, you can ignore. The voice you have heard and are hearing in your heart, however, is that of God. Him you should not ignore. Listen to his voice. I know that you'll find your lives and our state will be blessed for it, and that our continuance as a nation depends on it. Thank you, and may God bless you.
Thank you, Mr. Nagy. Does anyone have any questions? Thank you so much, sir. Our next speaker is Mr. Robert, is it Sling?
And I'll be very brief, and I believe you all have now a copy of what I'm going to say. I'm representing Eagle Forum.
Yes, sir.
Retired Army chaplain. I'm a minister in the Presbyterian Church in America.
Yes, sir.
And our church has officially taken a stand in this matter. God's moral law states that the killing of an unborn child is wrong. The special protection that God gives to a human life is founded upon his making man in his own image, Genesis 1:26. And in Genesis chapter 4, Job chapter 3, it stated that a man-child, when conceived, is not less of a man before he is born. Psalm 139, David marvels at God's involvement with him between his conception and birth. David writes, "For you formed my inward parts. You covered me in my mother's womb. I will praise you, for I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book there were written all the days that were ordained for me, when as yet there was not one of them." Jeremiah and Isaiah were both called of God from their mother's womb, clearly stated in Isaiah 49 and Jeremiah chapter 1. The New Testament says in Luke chapter 1, beginning at verse 24, that when Mary, the mother of the Lord Jesus Christ, visited her kinswoman Elizabeth, Elizabeth told Mary, when Mary told her that she was to be the mother of the Son of God, that the babe in her womb jumped for joy. That was John the Baptist. He was 6 months old at that time. Psalm 127:3 says, "Children are a gift of God. The fruit of the womb is a reward." Conception, gentlemen, and here I think I'm saying something new, is not a human happening. Apart from the sovereign intervention of God, conception will not take place. And therefore, abortion is wrong. No child belongs to a mother and father only. He or she is God's child from conception on. And that is why the church and the synagogue must speak out on this issue. We cannot be indifferent to the matter. And I appeal to y'all to pass Senate Bill 111. Please do it without the amendment which allows the so-called morning after pill to be used in the case of rape. This only confuses the issue. And if passed, it dilutes what the amendment means and is an invitation to have all sorts of other amendments. Please pass it just as it is without this amendment. My very final point is abortion, or the taking of the life of the unborn, leads to euthanasia. We are seeing that in many countries in the world. We recently saw it in the Terry Schiavo case. And my wife and I, in a visit to our son's graduation in Lynchburg, Virginia, met a couple from the Netherlands who came to Virginia to escape the possibility of euthanasia. These people were senior citizens, and they are now living in America because they were afraid to grow old in the Netherlands. And there is a connection between the two. I hope, in conclusion, that y'all will pass this Senate Bill 111 without the amendment. And I would just like to quote from a very great South Carolinian, "The duty is ours, the consequences are God's." And if you leave the matter up to Him and pass this bill, you'll be blessed for it, and you'll be surprised at how it is accepted, because I believe the vast majority of Christians and also people of the Jewish faith in South Carolina are strongly opposed to the taking of human life, including abortion. And even those who do not practice their faith have a guilt complex because of the home and church in which they were raised. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much. I want to make sure that we have folks who have not had their view heard in the remaining time before we come back to some more folks who are opposed to the bill. I'm just presuming, based on your organization that you may represent, so I'm going to skip around a little bit and ask Mr. George Johnson, if he's here, if he'd like to speak.
I am, and
yes,
I will waive the opportunity to speak. I think the views that I would represent have been represented.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir.
And Catherine Luchok, I think, Catherine, you spoke last time. Are you... criminal bill. Great. Okay. Fine. We are going to take that bill up. And the reason I hesitated today is we asked the survey of the other states to see what the action had been. We wanted to compare that to ours to make sure where we stood. Is there anyone else who is signed to speak who is in opposition to those bills? Yes, ma'am. Why don't you speak next? And you can tell us your name and if you represent an organization.
I'm Denise Williams from the American Civil Liberties Union in
yes.
South Carolina.
Welcome.
And there are just a couple of points that I want to make.
Yes, ma'am.
The Attorney General's opinion certainly stressed that nothing in this bill will affect constitutionally protected rights. And as of this point in time, the right to abortion is constitutionally protected. So I'm not going to address that. But what we are concerned with is the fact that this bill can lead to additional prosecution of pregnant women. And I'm speaking specifically in the case of low-wage workers who are uninsured, a woman that would skip having prenatal care, and as a result, some harm would come to the fetus. This would subject her to possible prosecution. Again, I'd also like you to consider the possible prosecution of healthcare workers who are involved in vitro fertilization, because routinely there are excess embryos that are routinely destroyed, and what possible liability will come because of this disposal of embryos. And I also, again, like to address the amendment.
I hate to interrupt you. I'm going to come back to the point. I understand the in vitro issue, what you were just explaining to me, but you made a point prior to that.
Okay.
Could you speak to that again about the absence of prenatal care and how that might relate to prosecution under this bill? I'm not sure I understand that.
Okay. There are low-wage workers who do not have insurance, who do not qualify for state-assisted medical care.
They may not get care. So
they may not get
care. How would that be criminalized under this statute? That's what I understand.
Not having prenatal care can result in damage and death to an unborn child, okay, or a fetus, and lead to miscarriages. And that's a potential liability because they've made a choice not to spend whatever money they have on prenatal care.
Okay, no, I follow you. I'm sorry. No, go ahead.
Okay. And then with regards to the amendment that permits or says that it doesn't prevent you from taking the morning after pill in the case of rape, we find that objectionable because we believe that the morning after pill should be available to any person who decides that after unprotected sex, they don't want to get pregnant. And so this bill seems, by implication, to outlaw or to prohibit the use of the morning after pill for any reason other than rape. And those are the points I wanted to make.
Well, thank you so much. You brought some new ideas, and I appreciate that. Any questions? Good. Okay. We'll go back up to the top of the list now, unless there's anybody else who's in opposition to the bill. I think the rest of the speakers are in favor of the legislation. I want to make sure they're heard as well. It looks like the next person who has signed up is Chris Sharp. And again, Chris, welcome. If you'd like, please make sure that we try to follow the idea of bringing new ideas or new testimony we've not heard before.
All right. My name is Chris Sharp. I represent Voice of the Unborn. I'm a retired civil servant of 33 years and retired from the U.S. Attorney's Office in October. My daughter, who is Kim, was fresh out of high school. By August, something terribly had gone wrong. I was curious about her change of heart, so I asked her to tell me what was wrong. And she told me, if you knew what I have been through, you wouldn't be so hard on me. The response in her silence about her life added to my growing suspicion. Normally she had been open about her life to me, but now she was closed and distant. Whatever had caused the pain, I knew it must have been horrible. I felt torn inside. A part of me wanted to know what was going on with her, and another part did not want to know. I knew at the age of 17, too many bad things can happen, and I just wanted to face what might be lurking behind her pain. So I chose not to see the clues until denial was no longer possible. It was then I had to face the truth that my daughter had possibly been pregnant. Ambivalence once again raised its ugly head. Deep sadness closed my heart as I wanted to escape the pain of the world and its reality. I found myself angry at God for bringing the tragedy abortion into my daughter's life. I found myself upset with God and my daughter. And at the same time, my heart ached for my child. I can only imagine her guilt and shame that kept her from exposing herself to me and the risk of losing what she thought would be my love and support. Even though my mind and heart floated between anger and sadness, I knew that I desired reconciliation with my daughter, the loss of my grandbaby, and with God. Mothers are nurturers, comforters, and life givers. We desire to take away the pains of the world, especially when the pain surrounds our children. The opportunity presented itself during the holidays, and my daughter and I were in the kitchen fixing dinner. As she stood over the stove stirring the pot, I began to stir the conversation with the hope of hearing her story about what had gone wrong. Finally, I simply said, "Are you pregnant?" The tears flowed out of her. "I'm so sorry." And I had an abortion. We both found the moment difficult. We had finally been reconciled one to another. She shared with me her brokenness and her independence and her dependence on the Lord to get her through the past months. As the days and months passed, the guilt, shame, and anger and sadness began to reappear. I carry this to this day. At that moment, time ceased for me. I felt as if I had witnessed and been a part of my grandbaby's death. Because I had been divorced and a single mom for 2 years, part of me feel guilty and responsible for my daughter's abortion. Even though intellectually I knew that unwed pregnancies and abortions happen regardless of family history, I still felt part to blame. The betrayal, anger, and sadness of a daughter's abortion enabled me to unleash the guilt and shame and relieve the burden in my soul. I felt I betrayed my daughter, grandchild, myself, and my Lord. The grief and sadness continued to envelop me until one day I cried out, "What's wrong with me, Lord? I need to tell my story to someone." I felt a prisoner in my sorrow because there was no place to grieve and no one to listen and understand my pain. I desired a time of mourning over the death of my grandchild, as well as the loss of my daughter's innocence. My fear was that she would now categorize her life in terms of before and after the abortion. In today's culture, we have few contexts to mourn aborted babies. We are prisoners in our own pain and grief. We are barred not only by our shame, guilt, and anger, and sadness by a world that refuses to recognize the trauma of abortion. For me, the grief felt enduring, and I wanted so much for the circle of grief to stop because I was becoming a depressed, angry, and desperate woman. Although forgiven, today I still feel surges of guilt and shame. I remember I wish I could have given her more guidance. I see the pain and sorrow in my daughter, and I feel my own sadness as I realize my grandchild is not around for us to enjoy. It is in these moments and memories of God's love and forgiveness that bring comfort, and I'm reminded that God is bigger than any of our mistakes, including abortion. Thanks be to God. Today I wear two trinkets, two of my grandbabies that I have now and one for the one that I lost. My grandbaby would be 15 years old, and I know that that baby is now in the arms of God and that one day I will see her again. And I know all these babies that we are talking about that are women that want to abort their babies. One day we're going to see these babies again, whether we like it or not, or whatever laws are passed, it's God's law that is predominant. And one day we're all going to answer for this, and we're all going to see this, and we're going to see our babies again. And I thank you for your time.
Our next speaker is Charles Butler. Mr. Butler? And I think that's the last person that signed up. Is anybody else that's not on the list that wishes to be heard this morning? Welcome, Mr. Butler. If you're speaking on behalf of an organization, if you'd let us know who that is.
Sure. I'm speaking on behalf of Souls of Fire Baptist Church in Orangeburg, South Carolina. And first of all, I'd like to say good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. And I'm here to encourage you to vote in favor of S-111 and H-3213. First of all, I'd like you to know that my family and I pray for you every night before our heads hit the pillow. We understand the importance of your job and the tremendous pressures you often face. It is our prayer that all of our governing officials will come to a saving knowledge of Jesus Christ and that God would give you wisdom in your very important decisions that you make. We believe that your position is divinely appointed by God. Even you have been divinely placed in office. Psalm 75, verses 6 and 7 says, "For promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south, but God is judge. He putteth down one and setteth up another." And I'm just here to simply say that you're here because God has placed you here. He's given you that divinely appointed position. And I want you to realize that the role of government was given by God. He's the one that orchestrated government. It wasn't man's idea for government. But back in Genesis chapter 9, God instituted human government. After the days of Noah, shortly after the flood, God told Noah, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man. And at the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. And whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man." This is the establishment of human government. And I just want to help you to realize that I know you have accountability to your constituents. I know you have accountability to the Constitution of the United States. But more importantly, you have an accountability to God. the Constitution and the citizens do not have a heaven or hell to put you in. And one day you're going to stand before God, whether you believe in him or not, or acknowledge him or not, and you're going to have to give an account for the things that you've done. And I would like to say I know that many people brought up many issues on legality and all these different things, but I think it is proper for us to make the right decisions and leave those other things in God's hands. The Bible says, for with God all things are possible. If David could slay the giant, you don't know what impact the decisions you can make in the right way. Don't allow the legality and the people, the doctors who really don't even know a whole lot. I mean, God knows everything, sway you. Do make the right decision and leave the rest in God's hands. And remember that God placed you here for such a time as this, and you don't know what impact decisions you make will have upon our country and upon our upon this world. So I just thank you for your time. I want you to know we're praying for you. We know that you have tough decisions to make, but we pray for you each and every day that God would help you and guide you and make the right decisions. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And whenever you speak of Ruth, it always gives us a little bit more of a burden here to carry, so I appreciate that. Let me say this. I have appreciated the way that you all have informed the committee on both sides of the question, all sides of the question. We've heard from folks with a background in medicine and the law who are based in their faith, who are based in lots of different aspects that helped, I think, inform the subcommittee on all three bills. The our challenge, and I think it's a serious one, is that we have two different bills, if you will. One is obviously the Right to Life Act, and the other is the Criminal Act, and we've sort of separated those into two camps. The Right to Life Act is, at a minimum, a direct challenge to the existing legal framework in which we view when life begins in this country. And so in that sense, it's a serious undertaking. If you go down the path and you support the Right to Life Act as laid out in its text and its logical extension, then the challenge of whether exceptions to that Right to Life Act make any logical extension is certainly a question that you have to explore. Our duty as lawmakers is not just to look at the framework within what our faith may inform us or what our constituents may desire, but to also look at the far-reaching impact of that decision in the rest of our society, whether it be in the law or in medicine or in the context of trusts and succession of estates or in tort law or in criminal law. And I think it's our duty to digest what you've given to us to make sure that if we go forward on a bill like that, that we either look at other statutes that we have to address, or that we just allow that to flow from the decision, as some of you all recommend, and let that go as it is. You've given each of us much to think about and much to consider in framing this decision and the vote and what we do with the bill to amend or go forward. 479, which is the criminal bill, is in the same context, and that is, to what extent can we legislate within current law without a direct challenge to the way the status of when life begins and what the rights of the mother versus the unborn child are. And in that vein, we have asked staff to produce for us a survey of what other states have done to make sure that our bill is either in conflict or complements what other states have done, and see if we are not going to buy ourselves a lawsuit so we can have the best language in order to protect or to meet our public policy goals as best we're able. And so in that sense, we're sort of threading the needle, if you will. So in that, given all of that, unless other members have questions or comments they'd like to do, my plan is to digest what we've taken in today, to direct staff to sort of give us a roadmap of what our options are within S-111 and S-479, so that we know where we are able to act without conflict, if we are going to go into conflict with existing state law, existing federal and state law, what our options are and what the impact is. And to carry these matters over until we're ready to deal with both those bills concurrently. Now, that may come before the end of the session. The Judiciary Committee may or may not meet again for us to pull these bills up. But if not, they don't die. For those of you who are not familiar with the process, those bills that are in play now will not need to be refiled next year in the event they're not passed this year. They just stay on the calendar, and they come back up again in January if we're not able to pass them out this year. So that's my plan right now, given all that we've heard and learned over the last, I guess, 3 hours of testimony with these three bills, unless any members of the committee have any comments they'd like to make. Okay. Thank you all very much. Stay in touch with the committee. If you have information you'd like to present to us, please feel free to do so. And those of you who asked for a transcript of this proceedings, I'm sure they'll work with you to get you a copy of that on CD or other form. Thank you so much.